Whoever you are, wherever you have come from, whoever you love, we welcome you. I'm Joel Slater, the worship associate, and Mike Hovensack will be leading today's worship. Lent services are a time-honored Unitarian Universalist tradition. We believe that the Sunday service is best reflected in a variety of voices and experiences. We are glad to have you with us this morning. Chalice reading today comes from Jacob Trapp, The Simplest of Sacraments. Simply to be and let things be as they speak, wordlessly, from the mystery of what they are. Simply to say a silent yes to the hillside flowers, to the trees we walk under. To pass from one person to another a morsel of bread, an answering yes. This is the simplest, the quietest of sacraments.
Our story this morning is a true story, and it is also a sad story because it's about a little girl who died of cancer when she was only 8 years old. And it is a beautiful story because it inspires us to accept our lives and to do the very best with what we have while we can. Alexandra Scott had been a fighter her entire life. Before she even celebrated her first birthday, she was diagnosed with a form of childhood cancer. And the doctors told her parents that even if Alex survived, she probably wouldn't learn to walk. But just 2 weeks later, Alex was able to slightly move her leg, and by the time she turned two, she was able to stand with the help of braces. And then her family heard the bad news. Alex's tumors had started to grow back. The disease that she had fought so hard against refused to go away, but she never let up. Alex spent a lot of her short life in the hospital with other children who were being treated for cancer. When she was four, she told her mother that she wanted to start a lemonade stand when she got out of the hospital to help kids who were suffering like her. She made it sound so plain. There were kids who needed help, and she had a way, however small, to provide it. So while fighting her own battle against cancer, Alex and her parents held a yearly lemonade stand to benefit pediatric cancer research. Her first stand raised a staggering $2,000 as friends and family pitched in and word of this lemonade stand spread. The project just kept growing and growing, thanks to Alex's spirit, as people all around the world were moved by her story and her determination. Alex tragically passed away in 2004, but she did so knowing that her little lemonade stand had led to $1 million raised toward finding a cure for cancer. Her mission lives on to this day in Alex's Lemonade Stand Foundation, which continues to raise money and awareness. Despite her young age and her tragic fate, Alexandra Scott sought to make the positive difference in the lives of children. So when you are feeling sad or unfortunate, I invite you to remember the story of Alex and how she made the very best of her life in the short time in which she had to do so.
Today's service is about living life at life's terms. This is both a spiritual concept, it's a therapeutic concept, it's used in addictions work. It's something that's served a lot of people in a lot of ways. One of the most common ways that you may feel familiar with this is through the Serenity Prayer, which was written by the theologian Reinhold Niebuhr. It's used a lot in 12-step programs, and it goes, God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. So what would this have to do with addiction? It has a lot to do with it, because when somebody rails against things they can't change, when they expect the world to be a certain way and it isn't, they become bitter. They often anesthetize themselves through drugs or alcohol. This same concept appears as one of the main principles of Taoism, the idea that you find the flow of the universe and you find a way to fit within that and make that work for you. Find your voice within that, and through that you can find tranquility. It's a nice concept, but we're Unitarian Universalists, right? You know us. We like to circulate petitions. We like to picket things. We like to hold subversive potlucks, right? That's us. And so, you know, how could we be people who want to go with the flow? But actually, if you're going to be healthy and do those things, then you do want to embrace this concept. Because if, for example, you stand up for the things you believe in, you advocate for those things that are important, but you do it with the understanding that the universe isn't going to just bend to your will whenever you ask it to. That's how you do this in a way that's healthy, because then you make the change you can and you accept what you cannot. So in a sense, what I'm talking about with this whole service is that annoying disconnect between how we want the world to be and how the world really is. So what better way to illustrate an annoying disconnect than with a story about in-laws? So, this is the story starts with when I was just dating Stephanie. And, you know, I'd gotten to that phase in the relationship where I went from buying her meals to buying her durable goods, like bookshelves, things like that. And I was already toying with the idea of buying real estate, so I was getting into that kind of phase of romance. And it was obvious that it was time to meet the family. So Stephanie originally invited me to Thanksgiving to meet her mother's side of the family first. And so we took the drive to this beautiful Victorian house in rural Ohio. And on the way, I was trying to imagine what I would experience. And Stephanie had told me a bit about her mother and her aunts especially. And I really got the impression from that that these were strong, beautiful, independent women. And when we first arrived at the house, I got just a quick introduction. It happened that her mother and one of her aunts was right there at the door, and I met them right away. And just, you know, with what you can get from a glance, I got a sense that these really do seem to be strong, intelligent, independent women, and beautiful as well. This is good news, because, you know, when you're meeting the family, you're meeting the genetic layout of your partner. So this was good news. But, you know, even more exciting, I met the uncles right away. And these were a bunch of nearsighted pot-bellied men with receding hairlines. Men, I might add, who looked just like me. So this was quite a wonderful discovery. You know, I'd often fantasized about meeting a community of beautiful, strong, independent women who could tolerate men who looked like me. And you know, I thought I was fantasizing about this, but I thought it was like unicorns, like a myth. You know, and here they were, this actual group of women. So this was a wonderful, wonderful discovery to me. And but I decided not to tell the whole world right away about this wonderful community that I'd found. It's really because of sort of some cynical advice that my Hungarian grandfather gave me. He once said, "If you find a $20 bill on the road, do you hold it up and say, 'Hey, whose money is this?'" He said, "No, you put it in your pocket and keep your mouth shut." So I met these wonderful people, and I thought, I better not tell too many people right away. So I was excited to meet this family. But very quickly, things took an unusual turn. We were quickly brought in, and you know, it was Thanksgiving, so we were quickly issued a paper plate and some plastic silverware and a large slab of ham, each of us. And we went into the living room where there were probably about 40 people all circled around in that room in a big circle. And they were in complete silence. And I thought, I want to charm these people. I want to win these people over. I want to get to know them. And they're in silence. And as the meal went on, the silence continued. All you could hear was the sound of 40 knives cutting through 40 slabs of ham. And I thought, what is going on here? And then the oldest member of the family started to choke. And this wasn't a subtle kind of coughing, kind of ambiguous choke. This was like a writhing, heaving kind of choke. And I looked around. I thought, who's going to help this poor man? I looked around. Everybody was staring down silently at their plates, intending to ignore this drama going on inches away from them. And I thought, maybe I'm misunderstanding. Maybe I'm misinterpreting what's going on here. So, but I looked back at him, And he was turning interesting colors, and at this point was he was gesticulating. And a ribbon of saliva exited his mouth and arced kind of beautifully through the air and landed in the carpet. I thought, this guy is in trouble. And I can't just sit here and watch this happen. But I had a few fears. What if I did misinterpret the situation? What if I jumped up there and ran up and grabbed him and I'm doing the Heimlich maneuver and it turns out he's not choking and they're saying, why are you spooning with our grandfather? My other fear was that he really would be choking and I'd run up there and I'd be doing the Heimlich maneuver and this piece of ham would come dislodged from his throat and he'd spit it out and the family would say, now look what you've done. We've waited years for this moment. Why do you think we served ham? So I was worried, but you know, it was getting more and more dramatic, his struggle. And I finally thought, it doesn't matter at this point. I'm going to set down my plate and I'm going to help this gentleman. And I was just setting down my plate when he made a full recovery, completely on his own. And we lapsed back into silence and I went back to eating, but I chewed my ham very carefully from that point on. And on the ride home, I said to Stephanie, what the heck was that about? And she said, what was what about? Because this was normal to her. So I thought, okay, you know what? I'm going to meet her in a couple weeks for Christmas. I'm going to meet her father's side of the family, and that will be different. And it was. That was different. It was much worse. A bunch of non-talkers again, but this time I came equipped with conversational material. I found out a little bit about each person ahead of time, and I showed up ready to really engage with these people. So, for example, I went up to her father, and I said, now, I hear you have worked at the same tool and die shop for like 25 years with the same coworkers that whole time. And he said, yep. And I said, you know, 25 years, same guys day in and day out, year in, year out. I'll bet you've had some wild shenanigans and pranks and things like that. And he said, yep. And I said, well, what kind of pranks? What kind of shenanigans? And he said, oh, all kinds. On the way home from Christmas, I said to Stephanie, I am determined to make your family fun. I didn't tell her this, but my goal was to get him to be a bunch of poetry reading, crying Unitarians. But I wanted to really stir things up. So I spent the next year trying to learn things about her family. And all year, I was buying Christmas gifts that would connect their values and interests with things about me. So it would create this fusion of our interests. It would connect us in meaningful, deep ways. So I spent a whole year gathering information, spending money on gifts. And my goal was to create change. And you know what? That next Christmas, I created change. Because that family was unified in their opposition to my attempt to get them to open up. Right after they opened these gifts that I spent a year picking out, they unanimously voted to switch to a Secret Santa format, where each person gives and receives only one gift, preferably a gift card. But there's something that I realized about these people. These were humble, quiet, strong, spiritual people. These were people who do things like donate their time to rebuild houses that have been destroyed in hurricanes. These are people who are, as we speak, researching how to adopt children who are falling through the cracks of the foster care system. These are people who care for others' children when they aren't able to. And here's one conversation that they did not have. They didn't say, everybody gather around. Stephanie's bringing her new boyfriend for the holidays, so let's watch him very closely and copy everything he does. That conversation never happened. And you know, I told you that I was going to tell you a story, an annoying in-law story, and it took me years to figure this out. But I was the annoying in-law. Thank you for listening. This has been therapeutic for me.
Ding, ding, da, da, ding, ding, da, da, ding, ding. na, ding, ding, da, da. Da, ding, ding, da, da, ding, ding, na, na, ding, ding, da, da, ding, ding, da, da, ding, ding, da, da, ding, ding, na, na, ding, ding. Shiva Shiva Shambho Hara Shiva Shambho Hara Ramade
Please join me in the spirit of prayer. This is a rather short prayer that I think relates to the topic today, and it's found in a book that Garrison Keillor edited and selected called Good Poems by Garrison Keillor. This is called Prayer by Galway Kinnell. Whatever happens, whatever what is what I want. Only that, but that.
I let out a joyful cheer the moment my son was born. It had been a long, hard labor for my wife, and it was such a relief to see that journey come to a close. People told me that I would feel a rush of love and connectedness and compassion when I saw a child being born, and I can honestly say I was hit by that wave. I remember looking down and thinking, I would do anything for this child. But the instant I was having that thought, the midwife started calling out, "Code pink, code pink." And at the same time, our sister-in-law, who was in the room, began crying and pleading, "Please God, save this child." I looked down. My son was silent and gray. An emergency staff came bursting into the room and immediately pushed me out of the way and put our son on a small examining table next to the hospital bed, and they began frantically working on him. Right away, this paternal enthusiasm I had turned into confusion, stunned sense of loss and despair. I sat down on the edge of the hospital bed, and the midwife said, "You have to be strong for your child." And I realized she's probably right. We had a nephew who was born, and he had a little trouble getting his breathing started, and there were a lot of scary emergency interventions, and he's a wonderful, healthy, happy kid today. But when I looked back at the examining table, they were giving our son CPR, which I know is usually a last-ditch effort to save a life. And I looked back at the midwife trying to make sense of this, and I saw that she was crying. And that's when I realized this was a dire situation. A nurse came in and said, "Can we get you the chaplain?" "Yes, yes, anything. We were willing to say yes to anything that might make a difference of any kind." Moments later, the chaplain came hobbling in painfully on a cane. And even before he was fully in the room, he was calling out to us, "I don't know what to do for you." And as he got closer, our sister-in-law said, "Well, can you say a prayer?" And he said, "I can't think of any." And when he got closer, she said, "Well, can you say, 'The Lord is my shepherd'?" And he said, "I don't remember the words to that one." And then he stumbled through a very rushed version of it. And when he got to the end, he said, "That's basically how it goes. I don't remember all the words. What else can I do for you?" And I said, "Call Melissa Carmel Zeber." Our son died in our arms that day. The emergency crew did all they could and then handed him over to us, and my wife and I lay together in the hospital bed and hung on to him while the life flowed out of him. So here's a question for you. How do we live life at these terms? It's all well and good to talk about living life at life's terms, and we're talking about little annoyances and setbacks. How do we live life at the terms where we have no idea how we could possibly wake up tomorrow morning and go on with life at all? Well, let me take a step back, because nothing shared here is useful unless it somehow connects with something that can apply to your lives as a congregation. And I do believe that to be spiritual, we have to connect the deeply personal with the universal. So think about losses you've had, setbacks, traumas, maybe things you're going through right now. Maybe you've lost a home or a job, gone through a divorce, somebody's passed on. And I would challenge you to act on the things you can act on and let go of the things you can't. And why? Because here's what it looks like when you don't. Here's a story I'd heard that a man went to a rabbi and he said, "I don't understand. I'm a good man. I give to charity. I'm nice to people. I don't lie. And bad things have happened to me. Why me?" And the rabbi said, "Why not you? Do you think that if you give to charity and help old ladies across the street, that that somehow gives you a coupon that frees you from the rules of the universe?" What this man had been doing was living life at his terms. He decided, if I do these various nice things, then I get to be shielded from bad luck. Those were his terms. And when you live life at your terms, you become miserable. So the opposite of that is something called radical acceptance. Essentially, it's learning to accept the unacceptable. Now, I'm a therapist, and I run a grief group. And I have people who've entered that group saying that they've spent the last 20 years struggling with a loss. And what's happened in those cases were they had a loss, and they refused to accept it, or they railed against somebody who they felt they should blame, or some failure somewhere, maybe even derailed against themselves in their guilt, instead of accepting the horrible truth and focusing on healing. And as a result of refusing to accept that reality, these were people who 20 years later were in as much pain as if it were a week ago that they'd had the loss. So radical acceptance is a nice idea, but how do you do it? A big part of it is through community. The seventh principle of Unitarian Universalist faith is respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. A lot of people use that to talk about the environment, which is wonderful. I agree with that. But I would also argue that the interdependent web is also community. Here's why. If you drop one person in the forest miles from civilization, odds are good that person will be dead within a few days. If you drop a group of people in the forest in the middle of nowhere, their odds of survival is actually pretty good. The reason is they're going to develop a division of labor. Some people are going to build a shelter. Some people are going to watch the children and the sick and the elderly. Some people are going to try to get food or signal for help. They'll band together, their odds of survival are quite good. And when you think about that forest as a metaphor, how many times have we felt lost in a forest in the middle of nowhere? And it's through community that we survive. So, getting back to our story, within moments of our loss, Reverend Melissa showed up at our hospital room with a single white rose. And she placed that rose on our son's forehead, and she performed a ceremony welcoming him to the community. Welcoming him to this community. She did a lot of other things as well. And you know who else came to that room that day? Those in-laws I told you about earlier. They dropped everything and came there. They brought their strength and their silence and their unwavering support. And thank God they came as themselves, not as some cartoon version of what I imagined I wanted them to be when I first met them. They came as themselves and brought all of that with them. And that served us in amazing ways. But that wasn't all. You know who else supported us? Look to your left, look to your right, look at the people ahead and behind you. Odds are good you've looked at at least, each of you have looked at at least two people who were supportive. People performed music and readings at the various services. Tom Morrow put on a memorial concert right here in this church. People donated people brought meals. People told us their stories of loss and didn't turn away when we shared our story of loss. We'll never be okay with that loss. But we survived it. Shortly after September 11th, a reporter asked the children's television show host, Fred Rogers. They said, "What do we tell the children about September 11th? And he said something that I think is brilliant. He said, "Keep an eye on the helpers." Keep an eye on the helpers. When people heard about September 11th, they said, "What kind of world is this?" Well, I'll tell you. This is the kind of world where hundreds, thousands of people would climb on top of burning rubble to try to pull out any survivors, even perfect strangers. That's what kind of world we live in. That's what kind of community we all have. It's important that we let go of the things that we can't change and that we act on the things we can, often through community. And that is living life at life's terms. So you might ask, so how can I access my community, or who can I help, or who can help me? I would ask you to look to your left, look to your right, look at the people ahead of you, look at the people behind you. Let it be so. Amen. You are a strong, compassionate, talented group of people. Share those gifts with one another and be willing to receive them from one another. Go in peace.